Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love and Happy New Year. Happy 2014. Welcome to the first Vodka O'Clock podcast of the year. And today my special guest is returning guest, Eric Prism.
Yes, returning guest. Hello. Happy New Year.
Hey.
Very exciting. I'm number one.
You are. You're always.
That's how I'm going out. Number one. Giant number one fingers.
That's awesome. I'll have to get you like an engraved martini glass or something.
I like that.
So, it's been a really awesome year for you. You've made some comic book changes in how you're working and who you're working with and all sorts of stuff. So we are going to dive into like everything, I hope.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting year. Just I feel like I did a lot of writing and making, but not a lot of releasing.
So
definitely like a lot of behind the scenes stuff, I guess, happening.
That was my year as well. Yeah. So we might have some minor spoilers, but, you know, nothing that'll wreck any of the stories for you. And, you know, hey, it's an explicit podcast, so I tend to swear a lot.
Shit.
Yeah. Shit, God damn it.
It's 1 hour. Fuck.
Yeah, kind of. Some of them turn into that.
I'm
not hungover or anything. I did not drink last night, so it's kind of, I'm sure, very shocking for most people.
Well, I will say I am a little hungover, so I've got for you as well.
Okay, you've got enough to go.
I'm doing it for both of us.
All right, that works, because I don't need any more headaches. I'm fine. So, I guess last time you were on was, I'd have to go back and look now. Was Phil on at the same time?
Technically, yes. I mean, I think you and I talked, just the two of us. And then after that, we did a signing at Wild Pig where you talked with Phil and me very briefly.
That's true.
Was it a year ago?
It was about a year ago. Because Phil Sloan was your artist on Dead Horse. He's still the artist on the current volume as well. And I loved the book. I don't even remember. I guess I must have met you guys at a show or something. And
maybe. You know what it is? I think you must have done something with 215 Inc. or something.
Came
out. I probably contacted you along with, you know, anybody that would possibly read the book.
And I loved it.
Yeah, you were very, very kind to us. It's much.
And you got the first, you got the first Vodka O'Clock award.
Yeah, that was great.
Such as it was.
Yeah, we did very well. Thank you.
So it's so Phil Sloan, and you also have
David Halverson. Yeah.
So, who does phenomenal colors, but he's a fantastic artist in his own right, which you're working on the other project.
Yeah, I mean, I've just been really lucky with the artists that I've been able to work with. Like, David Halverson and Claire Connolly are both people that whose work I liked and admired and then ended up working with. And David was just – he has this awesome webcomic called Tales of Armstrong, which I don't know if you've seen. But it's all free and it's up, you know, at talesofarmstrong.com. Somebody tweeted about it. I don't remember exactly where it came from. And I just contacted him, you know, more as a fan and just said that, you know, I really liked his work. And he ended up, you know, reading some of the Dead Horse. Because I think at that time, Dead Horse went through a bunch of different sort of versions as far as how we presented it. And it had been a web comic. And I think he read, you know, the first issue or two. And then it was, you know, was pretty cool with it and told me he liked it. And we just sort of kept in touch, you know, for the next year or so. And I don't know if when I send it to you, I think by the time I send it to you, the main core team with Halverson and Phil was already in place. But before that, Phil had actually done all the coloring himself. So there's actually old versions of Dead Horse where Phil colored everything. But we were getting to the point where we wanted to do sort of like a month-to-month thing. And with all the pencils and inks and colors, it wasn't something that Phil wanted to do, and we needed a colorist. So, you know, I just took a chance and asked him if he'd be into it, and he was, and that's sort of how we got him.
Yeah, because I definitely think that it was – I remember seeing Halverson's name on it by the time I looked at it. But it's just – I love the presentation of the book, and you did the letters, right?
Yeah, I do all the lettering and some of, like, the design, like the interior pages and all that stuff. And
because that stood out for me, because the book does have like really catching fonts, like they work really well, and like when you have, you know, like a crash or, you know, someone, just a sound effect in the background or whatever, I was going to ask you specifically if that's, if you do that or if Phil pencils that in.
Both.
What goes
I mean,
on?
It depends. I mean, there's certain sound effects that Phil will ink in or pencil in. And there's some stuff that I do with Illustrator. So it depends. More so because, like, when we first started doing it, it came, the whole me lettering thing also was a financial consideration. Just because I couldn't pay a letterer to do it. So it was like, you know what, I'm just going to learn how to do this. And I had never done it before, but there's a ton of sort of resources. And I feel like I've definitely gotten a lot better having done this 6 issues. So at this point, I'm sort of comfortable doing most of the sound effects. But you can tell sort of the ones that Phil's sort of hand-drawn. They're always going to look better than what I did. But I've gotten to the point now where I could, like, mask stuff and put, you know, artwork in front of the word balloons and all that kind of stuff. So I actually like lettering a lot, you know.
Well, I think it's New Year's Day. Isn't it a tradition for one of the companies to do a big sale?
Yes, Comicraft. It started yesterday, and I don't know. It's like their annual New Year's Day. I bought myself 3 fonts. It's like I look forward to that thing every year. But if you're, you know, if someone's listening and they're lettering themselves or thinking about making a comic, today is the day to go to that site. And it's basically, I think, $24.14 is what you're going to pay per font, but you can get fonts that are, you know, $150, or the font we use for Dead Horse actually is their Comic Crazy font. I think that's $325, you know, on any other day.
Wow.
Yeah, it's great. And that site, they have a lot of really good tutorials, and they have a book, which I definitely recommend people pick up, which is a comic book lettering the Comicraft way. And you can get it for like $6 or $7 on Amazon. That helped a lot.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus it's like I'm like a notorious rewriter. You know, I'll rewrite to the bitter end on everything that I do.
Oh yeah, I can understand.
I can't sort of ever make my mind up about things. So the fact that I'm lettering, you know, when I get the art back in, you know, I'll rewrite entire, you know, pieces of dialogues or whatever, or change sort of the beat. Cause once you have the art, now the story is a different story. You know, it's not the script you handed out. It's become something else between two people. So having that sort of last step to go in there and really fine tune the presentation and how the story is told is, I would never give it up. You know, I mean, there's letterers that are better than me, but I don't know if I would ever want to not letter the book.
I've heard a lot of writers say that, and that it's always the same story. Like, well, I did it for, you know, to save a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, but you actually know what you're doing as far as graphic art goes. So graphic design and,
yeah, thank you.
It's like, I think if I were to letter anything, it would be as bare bones as possible. It would be a miracle if something fit into a balloon.
I think you sell yourself a little bit short, but with some of this stuff, like, you have to, like, for me, like, having Illustrator makes it very easy. I don't know what other programs people use to do that. But again, with that Comicraft site, with their, I think it's balloontails.net, one of those sites, they literally, like, anything that you can think of you want to do, they have sort of step-by-step ways to do it and accomplish it. So it's worth, you know, sort of trying. But I understand what you mean. Like, especially if you don't have the right software, it's probably a nightmare.
Right, yeah. Because I typically use GIMP for photo work.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does what I need it to do. Like, I don't need to get, you know, I'm not a photo retoucher. Like, I'll recolor some things and I'll, you know, blur some stuff out. Like, I can do very basic stuff, and that's always been enough. So, but lettering sounds like it would be a logical step for a writer to learn how to do.
Yeah, and plus I think, I don't remember who it's, someone had Twitter or something had pointed out, like, it really does make you appreciate the artwork more, because you're, you know, when you're viewing artwork zoomed to, you know, 600% you really, you know, appreciate all the work and everything that's going into it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Not that you didn't appreciate it anyway, but it's definitely from a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you're really sort of like in the middle of it, and it definitely helps to like balance out, you know, how that story is told, because, you know, again, the artwork is going to change things and bring new things to the table. And if you have a letterer, then if you're, you know, you're paying them, then, you know, you have to be sort of, you know, you can't see something and then just keep sending them changes, you know? So it's also another.
And if there's a typo, it is all your fucking
right,
fault.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's always your fault, and there's always a typo, and something is always terribly wrong, and it's always your fault as the writer. Right? Is that what works, right?
Right. Yeah, so you're just screwed.
Yeah. Unless it goes well, and then it's not, you know, then you have nothing to do with it.
Right. Because I know you're out there to, like, try and nab the big Eisner for lettering.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Know that's
literally, totally. What it's all about.
Oh, my goodness. So let's catch up on Dead Horse and where we are. The first volume introduced the core characters and had shown the readers like the beginnings of this mysterious abandoned city, Dead Horse, Alaska, right?
Yes. It was,
okay. So quickly recapping the highlights of the first volume, there's a girl named Elise who runs away from home. She meets William Pike, who is chased out of his apartment by crazy neighbors with an army of birds. Mm-hmm. And then the bus that they're on crashes.
Yeah,
and
the Sasquatch.
Right. So they come across this other guy named Edgar. And then, yeah, and so they're chased by the hitman called Sasquatch, who is just ridiculous and funny. So that's sort of like a quick idea of what happened in Volume 1. And it was just full of such bizarre, crazy, almost B-movie things, like the birds attacking and, you know, Sasquatch himself. And mysteries, very Maltese Falcon feeling mystery of, you know, that Pike's learning about his father and he's learning about congressional involvement and things about this town that nobody talks about. And how big is this story?
It's pretty big. I mean, the way I tried to you know, craft the thing was, you know, sort of on the surface, it's sort of this ridiculous, you know, absurd thing with silly dudes and plastic ape masks and stuff. But sort of underneath it, yeah, there's a lot of different sort of layers of a story. There's sort of this master thing that's underneath that within the first volume too. There's a lot of stuff that was sort of planted that hopefully will, you know, pay off in the second volume. But it gets pretty crazy. I mean, I've had the end, you know, since the beginning, and if I could sort of pull it off the way I want to, you know, I think it's going to be pretty big.
So how many issues are you thinking it might work out?
I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, as I sort of write these things, new opportunities and things present themselves, and maybe it'll go in a little bit of a different direction than I intended. But right now, the plan is to sort of end it with the book that's happening now. So it'll be 12 chapters altogether. So by the end of this one, it'll be sort of done, and then we'll collect both books into one sort of volume.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's always had sort of a definitive ending, and was never sort of designed to be sort of an ongoing thing. I mean, there's definitely characters and things that could get, you know, new stories told out of it. But sort of with the way that it's going to wrap up, it, you know, it may not be possible. But I
okay.
like, you know, things that sort of don't go on forever too. I like things with, you know, solid stories that have, you know, reach
that
a point
anything.
And then end and then, you know.
Yeah, that's how I am too. I really am a fan of a miniseries.
Yeah, me too, definitely. I think there's like with anything, even when if it's a really good TV show or something, there always is like a point with me where I hit like a fatigue where
yeah.
it just keeps going on and I've invested so much time I don't want to stop, but I also want to experience new things and new stories.
In the same exact way.
Yeah, and from a writing perspective too, I mean, I love it and I want it to be, you know, as perfect as it can be, but I also want to finish it because there's a lot of other stuff that I want to do.
That's a good point, too, because I've heard actors say the same thing, that, you know, yes, they appreciate a show that runs for 5 years or 7 years or longer, mm-hmm. but it's not that they don't love their character anymore. They're just kind of bored, and they need to just work on things to get that creativity out there.
Right. Yeah, and nothing could be worse than sort of getting to the point and then you're bored.
Yeah.
You know, with the story or what you're doing. Or you just, I never want to be just running through the motions.
Yeah. I think it's good to, that, you know, from a writing perspective, that you had your ending already in mind. Do you work backwards like that? Do you start?
It depends. I mean, it's always different depending on what I'm doing. In this case, I got the ending pretty quickly. And I did, in a way, I guess, work backward from there. I mean, there were certain major milestones or beats that I knew that I had to hit and were sort of designed, but the things in between definitely changed. There was things that I didn't plan on happening that happened. You know, Edgar, one of the characters that we meet in the first book, he was just a guy that was going to be at the bus station. And you were never going to see him after that. But
it really grew.
Yeah,
yeah,
and he just grew, and then I decided to keep him, and then all of his things that are going to be developed further, I started, you know, planting in the story. And things like that sort of, you know, just kind of naturally happen. And that sort of keeps it from getting boring, too. You know, if you know everything, then there's nothing to surprise you, so, you know, it makes sort of putting it together a little bit, you know, less interesting as a creator.
So I want to ask the spoilery question here.
Oh, the end?
Because...
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm not going to ask the end. No, well, I don't think it's about the end. But the senator, there's a senator that goes out into the congressional floor and kills himself right there.
Yes.
Where the hell is Homeland Security when this is going on? Where's the Secret Service? It's like, it's such a this wild moment, because you see this sort of thing on old movies and whatever, where just everything was different, or if somebody was brainwashed, like the Naked Gun, you know, like, I'm just going to brainwash this person to carry a gun into this, you know, arena. And it had this crazy feeling to it. But I know that whatever the mystery is that's starting to reveal itself around, you know, the building of this city that costs millions of dollars that nobody's using, that there's something.
Yes, within the, this won't spoil anything, but the senator's role is much bigger to the whole thing. I mean, we see him sort of as a little boy in the first book, you know, at the town where Pike's dad, you know, goes missing or whatever happens to him. And then by the second issue, and I've already sent you the first issue of the new story arc, but we actually experience the senator's funeral, and we're going to learn a little bit more about him and about his dad.
Yeah. And
but yeah, that's suicide. And that was like, there was that Bud Dwyer suicide. Are you familiar with that?
I think you told me about that.
Yeah, that was rough. But a lot of that, you know, had seeing that and that whole thing definitely sort of seeped into my consciousness as far as when that whole thing came out with the hand puppet and the televised suicide. It's crazy. And that's, I try to do that too with this book, is it's a sort of absurdist and it's a comedy. But there's, like, to me, some of the stuff is just very dark.
Well, it's, we live in a time that, you know, back in the 80s anyway, that the movies about the future showed us what we were going to become, which was this reality TV watching addicted culture. And, you know, seeing it, you know, like even the Hunger Games and stuff like that has those elements to it as well. Running Man and
mm-hmm.
like all these movies have always had that particular plot point about them, that we like to watch train wrecks.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's
and
definitely, at least in this, in America anyway.
Yeah. So when, you know, the idea that somebody wants to commit suicide in such a way and they're already a public figure, it's like, you know, that might be likely that somebody is disturbed enough to just do that in front of camera crews. And
there's something too, and it's going to sound weird, but there's something really great about that image of a gun to it. I know it's, as I'm saying this, I'm like,
it sounds terrible, but
yeah, you know what it is? I think in like there's that, the comic 8-Ball, this Dan Klaus comic, and one of the covers, was this dude with a gun to his head. And for some reason that image has always stuck with me. And there's another comic, which I didn't send you just because it's being developed now, that I'm doing with Will Perkins called, Gregory Suicide. Again, like, people are going to be like, what's going on with this gruesome guy? But,
well,
yeah,
I do love me some Will Perkins.
And that one too.
Oh, okay. But Will's great. So I trust you.
Yeah, hopefully will be completed by March of next year.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, when we look back at 2013 and comics news, that DC Comics Harley Quinn contest of drawing her trying to commit suicide in a variety of different ways, and I don't care how people want to defend it. It was just stupid and awful and insensitive.
Right.
But here, what you're doing is you're taking a character, and it's actually part of your character's story, and it's, you know, it's an element to it. It's not just some gratuitous thing, even though we live in a very gratuitous culture where people will stop and watch something like that.
Right. No, definitely. And there's, you know, it's intentional because there's just, you know, there's a lot of elements of birth and death and creation and making things and, you know, destroying things and sort of seeing someone destroy their own life. Sort of fit into that.
Right. Is the plan for Dead Horse that all of the issues for this volume will be out this year?
No. I mean, it would be great, but realistically, the plan is, I like that you said this year, and I'm like, well, you mean next year? No, it's 2004. No. I've waited.
No.
The plan is for 3 issues. The second one is being, the artwork is being done now. But it does take a long time, and then with getting it colored and everything. So if we can get 4 out this year, that would be great. But the plan is sort of to do 3. The first book actually took us 3 years to do. It's just that we had, again, you know, done it as a black and white webcomic, and then we had done it 3 issues with Phil coloring it. And then when we decided to get David and re-release it, we had 3 already ready and done by the time we re-released the first one, newly colored. So we were able to sort of do a month to month, and we put out 6 issues in 2012. But the only reason we were able to do that is just because we had been sitting on sort of the inks, at least for the first 3, since like 2010, we started.
Okay.
2009, something like that.
I know, Dead Horse Comic has its own Twitter account, so people can follow that and keep up to date with that.
Yep, and that's always, we talked about this last time. It's like, I have all these, every time I do a comic, I have like another Twitter account, and then I end up like managing one and then retweeting my, like, I just feel so dumb. It's like, what am I doing? Like, I have all these things. I'm like, I better send this out of the Twitter. You better update that Facebook page for your comic and then share it on your personal. It's like, you know what? I wish that I was just like, I had one account. That was it.
Right. And if it was easy enough, you know, where people could see, like on Facebook, because it's definitely easier to run a page, you know, the fan page thing, but then Facebook wants you to pay.
Yeah. And that drives me crazy too. Cause with Facebook for me, like running the Dead Horse page, I've paid to promote posts, I've gotten nothing out of it. I mean, maybe
nothing.
The post
yeah.
isn't correct, or it's not worded right, or I'm not taking advantage of certain things. But I've seen no sort of return on any kind of investment that I've done with Facebook posts.
What was really funny, because I tried it with one post just as an experiment to see what would happen, and it was a post linking back to one of my blog posts or something back on my website. So they took my $5 to promote the post and then rejected me. didn't say why, but they always reject everything that's, you know, if there's a naughty image they don't like
so
on their website.
So that was the content of the.
Yeah, so I don't even know specifically why. It was just like, and I'm like, there's no way to get a clear answer. They're just, you know, there's so many different reasons. Somebody, I can't even remember, but some other people have told me that their rejections were so laughable, the reasons that they got back. I'm like, this makes no sense, because they don't give you the $5 back. Like, we're rejecting you. We're not going to promote this.
And they keep your money?
They keep your $5.
Oh, that's horrible. That doesn't seem right at all. You should at least get, you know, you're paying for a service that you didn't get.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, so if you're not promoting it, and you're telling me, and then it started getting really annoying with, like, how many more engagements there were since attempting to promote it, basically, since promoting it. And, it, you know, I got, like, 65 extra, you know, views or something. And I'm like, well, you know, I understand that they need to make money, but I just don't like the business model that they're using, because it doesn't make any sense.
Right. And I can understand sort of where they're coming from, because, you know, nobody's been able to figure out how to monetize any of this nonsense. You know, it's like, right. there's really no, and now, like, I think it was Wired or somebody had an article about just the inherent flaws within the whole liking system on Facebook, that they built this thing, and now there's just so many people liking so many things and sharing so many things that it's all noise. I mean, none of it is having really any effect.
Right. And, well, a lot of things that people don't notice. I mean, obviously, if you're just liking and sharing stuff from your friends and commenting on your friends' stuff, that's the intention. Mm-hmm. But then whenever I see those memes like, oh, this little girl with this degenerative disease wants 1 million likes. Can we get that for her? And then you do it. And what happens is then they sell that profile or page and change everything in it. So they, you know, whoever owns it can be like, you know, I'm selling a page with 1 million likes, and then a business or whomever can buy it and automatically have all of those followers.
That's the problem. There's just awful people. It's just full of awful people. So you can never have nice things.
Yeah, we can't have nice things. The internet.
And the other thing, like just with Facebook in general, like there's plenty of comic pages or things or music or whatever that I've liked. I just never see that stuff. And then you have to explain to people they have to do some kind of weird update setting.
Yeah, you have to go in the settings and show.
What are we doing?
Yeah. Maybe it's like you're now better. Yeah, you're now asking your fans to do more work.
Right.
And Twitter you can, you know, obviously get lost in the noise like you're saying. So it's hard because the advice that I've seen from authors is they run one account, like you're saying, and that you have to have a balance of interacting as like a regular personal person and like just acting like a regular human being and not just.
Yeah, it can't be a straight up promotion.
Not just a promotion robot that's like, read my book.
Right.
You know, 8 times a day, read my book. And by the way, and fund my Kickstarter. You know, like you have to be engaging in other ways other than asking people for their money.
Right. No, that's like definitely a hard balance. And then there's so many times where I'm just like, you know what, I'm just going to not do it at all. You know, I'm just going to use a Twitter account. As a Twitter account, I'm not going to push, you know, promote my own stuff. And then the other, it's like, what do you, you know, you have to because no one else is going to. And then it's like, well, why am I having this conversation with myself? I have to get out of the house. You know,
yeah.
I try to get out of the house.
Need to walk away.
But it's tough. It's like, you know, because then, and I do, and I, you know, I'm constantly pushing stuff. But, it, you know, people are nice and it gets retweeted once in a while. But I don't know if I'm seeing any, you know, is it making any kind of difference? Maybe not. Maybe it is. I don't know. It's just tough.
I don't know. You can hope so.
Yeah.
But the Kickstarter fatigue gets to me. I'm like, you, if all you're going to do is tweet about your Kickstarter, I'm going to unfollow you till your campaign is over.
Right.
I've done that several times.
It's the whole thing is just silly. And it is, I mean, and then sometimes you back up and you just look and you're like, wow, it's nothing but people just talking about themselves. And it just doesn't feel like, you know, any real conversations are taking place. And then when they do, it's not the right platform for it anyway. So it's just sort of weird. You don't, nobody knows if you have like more than two people in a Twitter conversation.
It becomes a chat room.
Insane, yeah. And then nobody knows who's responding to what. And it's just nuts.
It is tougher. I got a little nervous when my mom told me this morning. She said, one of my friends told me I should be on Twitter. I was just like, oh God, my head's going to explode. She's like, I told them no, absolutely not. Thinking about Kickstarter though, have you ever considered going that route for any of the projects so far?
I've certainly considered it. Phil definitely wants to do it. I just definitely feel that I have not built up. I mean, I've only been doing this for 3 years, I guess now. I just don't have in my opinion, I don't have an audience. You know, I don't think I have enough core fans, you know, that would support it. So I definitely have like other, it would just be a disaster. So my plan is sort of to keep working and keep getting better. And eventually by the time the second book's done, hopefully at that point, we'll have some kind of, you know, strong enough base where we could do sort of a Kickstarter.
Okay.
But that's my plan. I mean, who knows? I mean, it may happen. I'm sure with the way I do things, I'll wait until that there's so many Kickstarters going on, the market is completely useless and it would be the worst possible time to do a Kickstarter. And that's when I'll be like, all right, we're in.
Yeah, we were talking about how we're so late to the game with everything. Like, we're just watching Breaking Bad now.
Yeah. No, with the new book, like right now we're doing pre-orders for, you know, if you read Dead Horse Book 1 and you like it, pre-orders are now open on the new book. We've actually made it. It's done. It's going to go to the printer. It's not called Kickstarter, but we could call it Kickstarter. You know, if you pledge, you know, $3.99 for the issue, I will send it to you when it gets printed, you know, and that's guaranteed. So in that sense, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm probably too old school, maybe. You know, there's something with – I have no problem with people doing Kickstarters, but I don't know. I always sort of feel like I have to just – do it alone in the woods somewhere and then come out and show it off.
Okay. let's not not forget.
Yeah, that's like my favorite quote I think I've ever said, that I have to go in the woods and do it alone and then come out and show it off, because out of context, that is
going to be quoted everywhere. So that covers Dead Horse, but you've also got Planet Gigantic, which has been ongoing for a while, and then you've got a couple other shorter projects.
Yeah, the Planet Gigantic, when did we do that? 2012, I guess, too. In October of 2012, David Halverson is the colorist on Dead Horse, and I put together Planet Gigantic Pitch, and we made like a 13-page zero issue that we sort of put online for free, and we sort of shopped it around to publishers. And then last year, now I can say last year, we signed with Action Lab. So that is actually, we're working on the first arc now, and we're going to finish that up. And then it's going to be released. I don't have any actual dates, but it's summer of 2014, which I think it'll be the first book that I have in previews, which is super exciting for me.
Very exciting.
That's maybe March, I guess. It's what, 3 months ahead, or so somewhere around March. I'll definitely be tweeting about it and being like, why am I doing this? But yeah, asking for people to pre-order it. But yeah, that's I love that. That book is a lot of fun. And that's a much different sort of vibe than Dead Horse. And for me, it's a relief. You know, Dead Horse is this, you know, it's a mystery. So there's lots of every sort of element sort of feeds into it. It's this big sort of elaborate house of cards. Whereas Planet Gigantic, I can just completely have fun and put, you know, giant robots and insect monsters and just have a lot of fun. That's like everything that I ever liked, you know, as a kid. It was sort of like the comic I would have wanted to read.
Well, the issue that I took a look at had two stories inside that, and it gave me that old school, like Savage Tales type magazine.
Yeah, I wanted definitely to do. Every issue is going to have sort of a backup story. So there's sort of a 20-page main story, and then you know, 6 to 8 page sort of self-contained backup story. Just from liking like those old the way like Doctor Strange was introduced and Strange Tales and all that stuff, and sort of really giving people, you know, a full experience. So it's not only the episodic story that you're going to get, but you're also going to get, like, you know, something sort of self-contained and unique. So I can, because I kind of like both of those things. You know, I do like ongoing stories that build, but I also liked sort of one and done type things. And doing those backup stories is awesome because we can be very experimental. You know, the one that you read is sort of an adventure type tale of this this woman Liana, who's searching for sort of an artifact. But some of the other ones, there's one about a frog runner, a frog who's got to deliver a message about a war, and there's going to be another one that's, you know, maybe completely silent. And so I'm basically free to sort of tell whatever tale I want from this planet. And so it's just a lot of even more freedom, you know.
So is Halvorsen going to be doing all the art, even with the backup story?
Yeah, I mean, if we ever get to the point where we're behind in time or something, then maybe some other artists you may see come in for some of the backup stories. But right now, it's going to be him throughout the whole thing.
Okay, because I really dug those two stories together.
Well, thank you.
It's
definitely like with that book too. I wanted it to be sort of reminiscent of some of the older stuff, but I also was very important that it's not sort of nostalgia based, and I don't want to keep doing things that, you know, you get a lot of stuff where it's like, hey, you remember that, and it's just that thing that you remember, just redone. I want it to be something right. New and unique, so sort of take all those elements of things that I liked and sort of transform it into something new. So like the cover, like I love the way that the cover came out on that one. And I would tell you can post it. I just don't know what the rules are now since it's with Action Lab. But
they'll let me do anything.
Okay. I love that cover, and it looks very much like an old, you know, an old comic cover. But it also, to me anyway, it looks sort of modern in a way too. And I didn't want it to look like, to make it look like old wrinkled paper or something. You know, I don't want it to be something it isn't. I want it to be something sort of new and old at the same time.
Right. It's just so funny that very recently I started reading, and I only read the first issue. I think only two issues are out. Black Science.
Yes, that's awesome. I love that book, and we'll go on, and I'll say whatever.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I also, like, just watched, because, again, I'm way behind the times on everything. Like, I just watched John Carter.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
You know, it was enjoyable. Yeah. I thought the alien creatures, all the creature designs were just really phenomenal. You know, I don't know that there was a whole lot of story there, but it's funny how it's all of this very classic science fiction is being modernized. Everything's very contemporary now, and people are, you can tell because of how dialogue is updated, and like the kids that you have, are they supposed to be twins in your story?
Yes. Well, I think they're 6 minutes apart or something, but yeah, they're to give a little brief intro on that. It's these genetically enhanced kids that are sent into space to sort of explore. Whereas now we sort of spend money on rovers and we land them on Mars and they, you know, walk around and gather data and stuff. In the future, right. Corporations have cloned humans and gave them sort of, you know, superpowers. The two kids, one can control electromagnetic energy, and the girl, Valentina, can manipulate, you know, gravitational fields. And so they're sent into space and something goes wrong and they land on this crazy planet full of, you know, giant monsters.
Right. And the intention is that, you know, we're here to collect data, not return. Right?
Yeah.
That
they, yeah. So they would be sent out and that. They would just sort of look for mineral deposits on asteroids or just someplace where, you know, the human race, if they find like, okay, there's a whole bunch of minerals on this one asteroid block, they're going to send a message back. And then, you know, a big, you know, mining ship or something is going to send that, go that way. So there's the intention is too, there's other, they're not the only two that were made. So maybe we'll see other ones.
So what was your feeling then when you took a look at Black Science? Because it was, it's a very, not to say it's not an original story because it's original, but, you know, people are, you know, sent off across a particular border and now they're trapped and how are they going to get back? And the clock is ticking and they're going to run out of oxygen and whatever. So, it's, you know, it's something that's done a lot, but is always done a different sort of way. So Black Science was really fun, and I really liked the art on that.
Yeah, the art is
like
beautiful.
Totally blanking like a jerk on who did it, but I was surprised to see that the art had like strong colors that were brighter. That's what made it feel more vintage to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're like, they're not afraid to use pink, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. No, I completely agree. I love that book. I mean, I got the first two issues of that, and there's definitely some stuff there that's happening that is in line with, you know, with what I'm trying to do with Planet Gigantic. I mean, they're definitely way different books. But I love, it's like everything is, that's right up my alley, that story. So I love it. I'm actually, it's Matteo Scalera. I just had to look it up because I've forgotten his name too.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, because I was going to try to run it too. I'm like, why is my computer taking so long?
Yeah, no, I like that book a lot. And all those kind of things, like within the first issue of that with the giant turtles. And, you know, there's all of that kind of stuff is in Planet Gigantic.
Yeah. I mean, like, what is it with like frog monsters too? Like, cause I know you know, you talked about Will Perkins and they, in the Beware comics, they have, frogmen mm-hmm. and like frog creature things are really freaking scary.
I don't know. I think there's just something to, you know, for me, a lot of that stuff goes back to when I was a kid that being way into the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah. I remember that.
It was like, seeing those all sorts of creatures like that, and there's always frog people and mothmen and just sort of something that isn't sort of this reality.
That's good stuff. Good to see people are keeping that alive.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's so fun about too with Planet Gigantic is there's no rules at all. You know, I don't have to worry about sort of rationalizing and figuring out scientifically, like how is this possible or not? You can just sort of have fun. Like without spoiling one of the future issues of Planet Gigantic, there's these big, huge dudes that walk and people are in little ships on top of their heads. Very much like, you remember the Time Bandits with the big guy walking in the ocean with the boat on his head?
No, I don't know if I ever actually
really?
Watched
that's like,
that.
That's a great movie. But those kind of like sort of crazy, big, really big, like that's sort of the effect I want to have happen when people read Planet Gigantic because it's very, very big in all ways.
Right. So again, we were saying how to compare the types of writing that you're doing, like how Dead Horse is specifically a mystery with like you could connect the strings all over the place, and then Planet Gigantic is very sci-fi and nostalgic and everything. And then we have Chickens.
Yes.
What? I mean, like, where did Chickens come from? Because it might surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, that was a story that I had for a long time, and I just hadn't been able to find the time or the right artist to sort of tell it. And to give a little brief sort of overview on that, that's sort of set in a world where animals are running things and humans are what they eat. So it's basically our society now, but it's just flipped, you know, and animal rights has always been an important thing for me. And it was just a way of, I wanted to sort of tell a story with like that without being preachy, without, you know, making it reality based. I figured flipping it and putting, you know, people's perspective through the animals and seeing humans the way that, you know, that we really don't look at animals, but the way they are treated. And that's a tough book, too, just because it's the way I describe it. Again, I talk about how the humans are eaten for food. You don't really see a lot of that, at least in Chickens. In that story, it's really just about a family that's running a boarding house. It's like a mother, her daughter, and their son that are running a boarding house in this small town, and how the small town is sort of affected by the slaughterhouse and the poverty and the types of jobs that people have to get there. And it's really about that family and how that family functions, you know, or doesn't function. And sort of,
right. The relationships are very human relationships.
Yes. Yeah. And that was important to me. You know, I, you know, like the idea that applying all that humanity to sort of the animals, to so hopefully, you know, people will read that and they will sort of maybe look at things a little bit differently, or actually look at things that they probably aren't paying attention to.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. And you even have like the interspecies relationship going on with like the the pig man and the chicken girl and you know, these are just typical things that, you know, we go through with, you know, as far as people are concerned with, you know, what color you are and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. And I wanted for that to, you know, sort of to have, we got a review, we got a very good review from Comic Bastards, and he mentioned in the review that sort of that the animals sort of correspond to nationalities, but that wasn't really the intent on my part anyway. But there is sort of a class system, a, you know, socioeconomic class system with the animals. And when we get into the intention of the book is the first one that you've read. It's a self-contained story called Chickens, but there's going to be three others, one based on pigs and one with cows. And the cows are sort of the elite factory owners and stuff within the town. So in that sense, it's sort of divided in that manner.
Oh, that's really cool because you know, like you said, it is very contained. People don't have to worry about it. But I was curious about, you know, what are other animals like? Because at least here, you know, we don't eat dogs and cats. So, you know, are what we consider pets going to show up in one of the stories?
No, but that's actually an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about that. Now, the animals that, you know, all the animals obviously are based on animals that we eat. So you have, you know, chickens, pigs, and cows. But as far as them having pets too, I hadn't really thought that part through. That's an interesting thing.
Have you read the John Lewis graphic novel that just came out called March Book One?
No, I heard about it. That was good.
Yeah, it's very good. I'm halfway through. It's and it's about the civil rights movement. And when he was a child growing up, he was in charge of taking care of the chickens.
Okay.
And it's just. It was so interesting that I had just read Chickens, like, you know, I don't know, a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And then I was reading this book this week because he grew to, for whatever reason, out on the farm, because he was responsible for the chickens, he really revered them above everything else. So he didn't become a vegetarian, but he couldn't eat the chickens that he cared for. You know, if he went to somebody else's house and they served mm-hmm. it had a different effect on him than, you know, raising them and being attached to them. And it was, you know, because of the type of person he was and he wanted to be a preacher, he used to practice sermons to his chickens.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's a really, like, a lovely moment about how we do connect with other things out there on our planet.
Sure.
And yet at the same time, you have to compartmentalize them because, you know, he still had to acknowledge that was food to him. I'm not completely vegan, but I'm pretty close. I'm impossible to go to dinner with, as now anybody who takes me to dinner has learned.
Yeah.
Because, at least, you know, here in New Jersey, it's not easy to find places that even care remotely to learn how to make a few vegetarian dishes.
No, yeah, I mean, there's so many places that's not even an option. That there's, you know, I hate that when you go to, I'm a vegetarian, I'm not a vegan, which is sort of hard to deal with because I realize all the things that I'm getting from, you know, milk and cheeses and stuff is just as, the reasons why I'm not eating meat also apply to why I shouldn't be doing these other things.
Right.
But you're right, like if you go to so many restaurants, you just look through the menu and a lot of places don't have anything.
Yeah, some places have nothing, or they're like, well, we can make you a salad.
Right.
I'm like, well, thanks so much that you know how to, like, chop up lettuce, you know, and maybe a tomato if I'm lucky.
I'm lucky in that I live not far from this town called Red Bank, and there's an excellent vegan cafe in town, you know.
Oh, that's really good. See, I pass the Loving Hut on my way home. It's just usually on – like my commute, as I was telling you earlier, is really, really far. So I don't stop there very often, but everything's vegan. So like the cheesecake and the meat, like all of it is fake and made out of wheat protein or soy protein, and it's so amazingly delicious. I love everything there. And yesterday, since I got to leave a little bit early for the holiday, I was like, that's it. I'm stopping at Loving Hut. I'm getting a good sandwich. And it was so nice.
That's
because
how
I was
you
out
should
over...
end 2013.
Yeah, I was out over the weekend, and I was grateful just to find a bar that had hummus on the menu. I'm like, because hummus is literally like the cheapest thing that you can make. It like costs you a dollar. You serve it with some pita or some veggies, and you know, it's really not complicated at all, and it's wonderful. It's delicious, but you know, it was like 10 degrees outside. Like, I really wasn't in the mood for hummus, but I'm like, what are you going to do? When I was just so grateful that that was on the menu. Because even soups, you have to be careful with. A lot of soups are based with chicken
absolutely.
Stock. Like, you can't tell me that that's a tomato soup or that that's a chicken soup or a cream of potato soup when you're using chicken stock.
It's very hard. But, you know, you do find ways. You know, it's definitely not impossible. But, you know, you're right. It just gets frustrating.
It does. So in a time where, you know, I guess things are adapting and evolving and, you know, like dealing with diets within people's households is getting really crazy. You know, you might have a sugar-free person and a gluten-free person and a vegetarian all under one house. It's like, oh my God.
Cool. But yeah, so to get back to chickens, it's available now and people can download it for free. So, definitely encourage anyone that's made it this far into, and I didn't put them to sleep with my voice by now. Go and pick it up and download it. And you can put $0 in. You don't have to put a credit card, or you can put money in. Money's okay too.
Right. So it's a really cool thing that people are doing these days with a sort of like tip jar, pay what you want. I know Jeremy Holt did that with pulp as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cool thing.
Yeah,
I like it. I mean,
we did that too with the single issues of Dead Horse too, that with the PDFs. But it's cool. I mean, I just want people to read it. It's definitely a very important story to me. So I hope people like it. I worry though. I worry that if people, the way I sort of sell it to, and you can probably speak to this, whether or not it's, you know, are people not wanting to read it because they think it's going to be this very dark? I mean, the people that did review it, I heard that back from a lot of people. Were like, this was not the story I thought it was going to be. You know, people sort of go in thinking it's going to be this horrific, you know, slaughterhouse story with humans, and that's not it.
Right. I think that I could see how that would be expected if you're saying, oh, this is a story and it involves animal rights. But it's, I mean, like Black Sad anthropomorphized animals. And, you know, but it was detective and crime solving stuff. So, I mean, I think people are, if you explain a little bit further about the, how the characters actually are developed, then I think it would be, something maybe more people would read without being so afraid of it. Like you said, you don't want to sound preachy, and it's not, they're just kind of mentioned, like the humans are sort of like way in the background. Like you don't even... you know, it's not a main element, and how the sister and the brother are getting along, and the poor mom is trying to run everything,
Claire Connolly's artwork is amazing.
It really, really is. The characters are relatable, even though they're, you know, pigs and chickens and stuff. They're still relatable. How did you find Claire anyway? Did you mention that?
She was another person that I was a fan of her works. She's not far. She doesn't live far from me. And there's a Asbury Park Comic Con that I had been going to since the beginning. And so had she and her sister Paige. And so Phil and I would table near them and we just, you know, got to be friendly. We've done some signings and stuff together. And when actually before Chickens, there was an 8 or 9 page short story that I did on Challenger Comics that people can read for free now. I couldn't find an artist for it. Like originally it was going to be sort of a thing for an anthology, and I approached Phil and I asked Phil if he would do it. He didn't want to do it because he just wasn't comfortable with the content of the story. So I went to my blog and just wrote and said, you know, doing the story about animals and, you know, if anyone's interested, and she responded to it. So that was, it was amazing. 'Cause for me, that was totally the perfect art style for it. I had been a fan of her, and she was interested in doing it, and I sent her the 8-page story. She did it. We really liked working together, and so we decided to do a bigger thing, and that's where sort of the chickens and the other three-part sort of graphic novel thing came from.
That's really cool because, like you said, it's, even when you have a really great relationship with an artist, it's sometimes you still have to look at the style, I don't know if you read any of Brubaker's noir stuff, but it seems like every book kind of looks exactly the same because that's the stories he's telling. But when you're telling stories that are so varied, you really want somebody who brings out the best in it and makes it better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're totally, completely right.
Yeah. So Claire, I loved that it was very sort of like a sketchy, disturbed, almost like there's so much anxiety between these characters getting along that it really came out just simply based on how her line work is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree. I mean, getting those kind of pages back was amazing. She's a great writer, artist too, in her own right. I mean, if you go to Claire Connolly Comics, I think it is, .com, she's got some awesome, a lot of awesome, really beautiful shorts that are almost always silent. There's just a lot of, story being told with very little words. It's very good.
So now that we're just kicking off a new year and you have all this amazing work, where do you get inspired? Like, does science news actually inspire you in the work or any, like, other?
Yeah, I mean, definitely sort of science stuff. But I think most of the stuff that I pull from is probably movies, more so than comics. And that's not that I'm not completely inspired by comics. And there's definitely a lot of sort of Fantastic Four that's made its way into sort of where I was coming from with Planet Gigantic. But I just always feel like it's more interesting to take things from outside of comics and bring them in. Than it is to take things that are already in comics and bring them back because you're more likely to just do sort of cliched things than sort of create new stuff.
I heard Len Wein and Ben Black do a podcast, and I'm blanking on the third guy's name, on the Nerdist Writers Panel. They do a comics-specific writers panel. And they were talking about definitive story runs, and they were talking about Daredevil, and that certain characters and certain comic titles definitely do have something, a time period when a writer, an artist, really defined what they were and who they are, and that everybody afterwards is definitely pulling from them. So I can see how, if you are working on original comic work, and you are a fan of the Fantastic Four, that's of course going to get in there, or Nova Corps, or, any Green Lantern. I mean, it's very big space odyssey and stuff. If I can see how that stuff is going to start, bleeding in, like, the Shia LaBeouf way, the completely plagiarizing way.
I don't know what to make. That whole thing is so crazy. I still sort of, part of me thinks that it's just some kind of long con, elaborate art project that's going on, and we're all involved in it. Like, when the apology itself was taken, and then there's the thing with Alec Baldwin, and he wrote that email, and it's just like, either he's just completely crazy, or it is sort of like, this, the Joaquin Phoenix sort of, whatever that movie, remember that movie that he did? Joaquin Phoenix, where he pretended he was a rapper, and he made up that whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, where he stayed in character.
Yes, and it all turned out to be, a hoax. It almost feels like, it's crazy.
Yeah. So there's ways to, obviously, we're all inspired by something and pay homage to things that we love and appreciate. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you have to.
Yeah, and I just think it's just more interesting to take something from another form that hits you in a certain way, because there's, sort of, whether it's artwork or, music too, that just sort of, and then transforming that into a new medium, I think that sort of process from going from one through you to another is just a much more interesting result, than dealing with something that's already been transformed into to comics.
Yeah, it's tricky using music, because I know there have been some recent articles about what's allowed to be used inside the comic.
In terms of song lyrics, but I mean, song just lyrics? In sort of how music affects you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, how it affects you is one thing, but it's, I start to get lost in all of the advice about that, though, if you are going to try to quote lyrics and things.
Yeah, everything that I've read pretty much says don't. It's a sort of they're copyrighted material, and I guess record companies have been known to go after people. And again, I mean, you're making your own thing, so why bother? If it's like a sort of a snippet here and there from a song you like, I think that's sort of okay. But yeah, you got to be very careful.
I think it's part of where the line for fair use is, like, if you're setting your characters to be a certain way and they're listening to The Cure, mm-hmm. and it's a critical part. Like one of the really fun miniseries that I read this year is called Mixtape. So it's completely about people sharing music with each other and how, you know, life when you used to hang out in record stores was, and I was a college radio DJ back then when this was when the story is taking place. So I could relate to it. I could be like, yeah, we made cassette copies of things,
right,
and shared them with our friends. Well, of course we did. And music was a big part of that particular scene. So when you're writing a comic specifically about that, it's like, how do I do this without, you know, violating other people's property?
You're right. I mean, it's very sort of gray area, and I wonder if it just has to be if you're actively, you know, acknowledging the artist, like if you made an unauthorized biography of someone, if that's okay. Whereas
that actually is okay.
Yeah. Whereas if you're taking their lyrics and using them out of context without crediting, I don't know. It's very. You're right.
The unauthorized thing, because that's not to plug them, because I'm not fond of what they do, but Blue Water Comics, that's what they do. They take celebrities, so mm-hmm. it's already somebody, a public figure, so at that point they don't have the same claims as a private person, but they write comics about famous people.
Now, do you know, because I've never read a Blue Water comic, but I'm familiar with that company, on music books, do they have the lyrics or anything in the book, or is it just a biography and then they never show?
I think it's just a biography, because I know one of my friends worked on the Lady Gaga one, and I don't know if the lyrics are in there at all.
Okay. Yeah, so lyrics are very strange. It's very strange. And I feel like, wasn't there just like one of those lyric sites was just taken down? Those sites you get all the lyrics, or for whatever reason they were doing something with Google.
Yeah, that's so weird, because, I mean, they're so, like, useful. But yet on YouTube, you can make videos all the time. Like, I see that whenever I go to look for a song on YouTube, it'll be something that says, official lyric video.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like, what's official about your video?
It's a wonderful and terrible time that we live in, I guess.
Everybody wants to love art, but nobody wants to, like, nobody wants to pay for it.
But speaking of The Cure, there, I will do a little spoiler in the second chapter of Dead Horse. Maybe you see Pike dressed as Robert Smith. It's possible.
Oh.
There was a lot of Cure going on when I was writing. There's usually a lot of Cure going on in my life.
I already have a crush on Pike. I already have a you know, fictional nerd crush on Pike.
Nice.
So. You know, because I haven't been reading Batman these days, so I gotta move my fictional quest.
Yeah, I definitely do that stuff too, like as far as putting things that I like in the books. You know, there's Edgar's wearing a David Bowie shirt, and a lot of that stuff I just don't even think about that being a problem. And I don't think it, I mean, I can't imagine that would ever be. That's, I always think that's, if that, something like that ever would have happened, it would probably be a good problem, because it'd get me a lot more publicity than I have right now.
That's true. Yeah, I could see that happening and be like, okay, I suppose I could change it. And then there's also the use of parody, which is totally different conversation. But speaking of Edgar, before I let you go, what I wanted to ask you about was that when you're developing characters, you know, and I know that this is sort of like, it's a high profile problem in like the bigger books, like, you know, the DC Marvel books and stuff, about how female characters are treated and how homosexual characters are treated and bisexual characters are treated. And when I, you know, when I went through and read the new, you know, the newest issue of Dead Horse and read Planet Gigantic, and it's, you have such a well-balanced cast, but it doesn't, it's not shoved in your face. Like, it's just, it seems like you just created characters that were personable. They've all got their own individual personalities, and it's not like I'm introducing a gay character.
Yeah, no, and that's, and I don't know. I don't think it's a, I guess it's a spoiler or whatever, but it's not like the character of Edgar was always gay. It was just, he was always gay. And I had in the second, I think it was all the way back in the second issue, I had a conversation between Elise and Edgar, where he, you know, told her that he was gay or whatever the conversation. And I, it just seemed so dumb. It just didn't feel like it just, I just want the characters to feel that they would in the real world. You know, they're real to me. So I have to present them as real people, and it just didn't seem right. And so then he was always sort of gay, but I never said it. And you do, I do say it in sort of as in a joking way in the issue you read. But even that I sort of struggled with, cause I didn't, like, I felt like maybe I don't even need to say it at all. Like, these, again, like what you were saying, and I'm glad to hear that, is I just want them to be sort of regular people the way, you know.
Well, it's because how they banter back and forth is so funny that it came out exactly the way that you would expect these guys, you know, who they're in danger together and they're new friends and they trust each other. And, you know, it was just – the snark is always like, it's just so there, especially with Elise. That's why, like, I did that snippet of the panel the other day and put it on Twitter. I was like, you guys need to have this.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, she's I have the most fun of all of them, I think, writing her.
And, you know, I mean, you, it's like, it doesn't seem like any kind of big deal. Like, you're writing a female character of significance in that story. And then in Planet Gigantic, there's, that you have like this queen who is very significant, and you have, you know, one of the kids is a girl. And then the second backup story is all about a female character. Mm-hmm. So it just seems, I don't know.
Yeah. For that, like that society or the world of Planet Gigantic is all, you know, run by queens. So and that was tough actually too, because I'm so used to writing the word kingdom. And so I just wanted to create, if I'm going to build a world, I was going to create a society that is, you know, female based, whereas ours, you know, where you have sort of kingdoms, and in this one, it's all queens. And so just trying to change the language and doing that, and just trying to make it sort of work, you know, and that was tough, like, because there's so many words just built into our language that are sort of just inherently sexist or what have you, that like just writing things and then changing them, and then queendom just sounded weird. So it ended up being realms. But
okay,
yeah, it was definitely sort of a, you know, an intentional thing that I wanted to do, just because it would be, it's much different than sort of the world that we're in now. So if I'm going to make a new one, you know, that's the kind of world that I kind of wanted to play around in.
I did love the queen's design, by the way, too.
Yeah, she's awesome. David did an amazing job with that.
I was looking at that and I'm like, oh, dream cosplay right there.
And she's a lot of fun to write too. And there's some stuff that's going to happen with her that's going to make her more interesting. And there's all the sisters of hers that we haven't met yet. So it's a lot of fun to play around on that planet.
That'll be great. We'll get we'll have stuff to look forward to for sure.
So
where can people follow along with the 8 different Facebooks and Twitters and things? You know,
the best thing to do is to go to my website, ericgrissom.com. And from there, on like the right side of my page, there's links to everything. So if you want to read animals, the free animals, and there's a short called Tom and Violence, you can order chickens. There's a link to the Planet Gigantic website and the Dead Horse comic website. So it's all there. That's sort of the main, you know, my main hub. That's a Tumblr that I have. And basically, I don't talk too much about comics. I basically just post a lot of photos of stuff I find that I like or inspiring or I think is cool. And I know you're not a big fan of Tumblr, right?
No, I think Tumblr gets really messy and things get lost there. Like
as far as accreditation.
Yeah. It's just like I'll see it and it'll be like, you know, 25 straight vertical lines of people's usernames, and I'm like, what in the fuck is this?
It does definitely get messy in that regard. And I try when I post something new, if I'm the originator of the image, I try to give the credit of the movie or the year or whatever, just so, or if it's a photograph, who the photographer was. But you're right, yeah, you definitely get, because when you share something, at least I think this is the way it's set up, you only see where you got it from. So you don't know where, you know, it doesn't immediately show you where they got it from. So you almost have to drill down, and you can, but you have to go sort of from connection to connection till you get to the source of who originally posted it.
Yeah, I have a Vodka O'Clock Tumblr set up specifically just to only have the links of the episodes, and that's it. Like, I'm not using it to propagate other things at all.
Okay. I like it a lot just for, like, I love sort of imagery and photography and stuff, and it's just great. I mean, just you follow a lot of cool places. Like, I love abandoned things, if that's not obvious.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
But there's great sort of Tumblrs that are just sort of like old theme parks that are being overrun, you're overgrown and like abandoned places in the Soviet Union, just like really cool images like that. And there's lots of good comic stuff. Like, I would definitely recommend maybe you give it a second chance, maybe not as your own blog, but just to sort of look around for inspiration. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I don't mind visiting it because one of my closest friends, Kristen McHugh, she uses Tumblr all the time regularly. So it's like the main reason that I ever go is because she's sharing something and I want to go see what it is. It's really funny because I actually found a bunch of my own photos on somebody's Tumblr and they were completely not credited and just stolen right off my website. And when I tried to use the form, like it says to like contact the person or ask or whatever.
Yeah.
I was just like, look, you've got like this picture, and then I would link to it and it didn't link directly to that post. Like it goes to the page, but the pages change all the time every time you post something.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even know if it was like the links don't even work correctly. Not like I suppose there's a way to do it. You probably just have to find the timestamp and have that as part of the URL.
Right.
And then it would work, but it just got so annoying. I was like, I can't believe there are like 100 of my pictures on this website that don't link back to my website at all.
I can definitely see why that would make you mad.
Definitely. Yeah, and I know, like, I don't know if you know the cartoonist Kate Leth, but she had a similar problem where she just kept finding her web comics like all over Tumblr, and she's like, why aren't these redirecting back to my website?
Now, with your photos, are you watermarking the photos in any way with your URL? I mean, that sort of takes away some of the beauty of the, you know, the pictures, the artwork, or the, you know, because it almost, you know, when you have to watermark your website, it always sort of makes it look a little corny.
It does.
But maybe that's
and so
it.
I was trying to avoid that with them, and I wasn't going to go back to earlier pictures and do it because there's just like hundreds.
Right.
But I do that now, and I try to just keep it in a corner or something. And then it's what's funny is I hear comic artists on Twitter that I follow complaining that people are cropping their watermark out and stuff like that.
But you're literally going out of your way to not credit the person.
Yeah, it's like just, you know, we want to know the source, you know.
This is good. While we were talking, I just hit because I have to type my own website in when I'm telling you what my website was.
Sure.
But Barbarella is being adapted by Kelly Sue DeConnick.
Oh, that's exciting.
Awesome. Love Barbarella. That's awesome news. Not just look at that. Sorry, a little
Go
bit of news flash. See that? So you get in an interview and breaking news.
I like this. I like this Eric Grissom, co-anchor. awesome. Okay. Well, I wish you the best. I will be running into you, I'm sure, several times this year.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And of course, you know, because are you going to maybe – I think you're going to get to come up for Free Comic Book Day, right?
I don't know what's going on with Free Comic Book Day. I may be in Delaware. I may be going up to you. I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't committed yet or figured out what I'm doing.
We'll figure that out.
But, yeah, thank you again. And, thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you want to to pre-order, if you need to get Dead Horse, the new Dead Horse in print and you want it in print, you have to pre-order it because I'm not going to be doing that big of a print run. If you want it digitally or on Comixology or whatever, then you don't have to do anything. But if you want a print copy, please sign up.
Okay, that's cool. Good, helpful advice. And while we were talking about links, you can, of course, follow me at Elizabeth Amber on Twitter, and amberonmass.com has everything else. And the podcast is on iTunes and Stitcher, and I'm really into Pinterest now, but I'm not like, you know, I don't produce much content as it were on Pinterest, but I do love the quote memes. I'm very addicted to quote memes right now.
See, now I don't know anything about Pinterest. Is that similar to Tumblr? Are you sharing
similar
images? Collecting images?
Yeah, it's all image based. But it's basically the presentation is different. Instead of it looking like a blog that scrolls vertically, like it's a board, as if you had like a virtual cork board, and it was changing all the time.
Okay, and that you see exactly who posted the original photo.
Yeah,
so that's cool.
Yeah, you should, because it should you should be able to when you upload an image yourself, you can do it from a URL. And because I've done that with some fashion things that I've found, and it'll tell you if other people have also posted the same image already, which is cool. But if you're repinning somebody else's stuff, then it notifies that person that they've been repinned.
That's cool. Maybe I'll check that out. That might be a good play, because I'm always sort of looking for reference photos too, and I sort of collect them all. I use Basecamp to share them, but maybe Pinterest would be a good way to do that.
Okay. I found some really cool, like you were saying, abandoned places and stuff. And I have boards that I follow for like tiny cottages, because I find them charming. Dream of not being here. So pumpkin carvings, makeups, I mean, everything you can imagine. So yes, that's my new thing, being over there on Pinterest a little bit. Well, Eric, as always, it's been a pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you again. Appreciate it.
You guys have a wonderful new year, and tune in again to Vodka Talk. Thanks.
Thank you.